Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Saturday morning Dhamma class from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on January 19, 2019. This talk and our Sangha discussion is on the second chapter of our Dhamma study based on my book, The Truth of Happiness. This talk is about Shamatha Vipassana meditation as the Buddha taught meditation, and is also a very clear explanation of jhana, ever-deepening levels of meditative absorption. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace.
The Buddha tried all of the popular meditation methods that were around during his time, and he studied with the most advanced spiritual teachers, spiritual in quotes. Who's that, David? Close your mic. And he rejected each and every one of them as simply not leading to his goal of understanding. And as he describes in the Arya Pariyasana Sutta and many others, there were... Let me, David's mic. If I can. David, I'm going to mute your mic. Okay. He realized that they were just more distraction rather than deepening concentration. That leads to what the sutta that I'll read today too. The Buddha wasn't trying to seek a way to establish himself in non-physical realms. He wasn't trying to appease or appeal to gods or goddesses or non-physical deities. He was simply looking if it was possible to find a way to understand the nature of human confusion and human suffering. And so one of his inherent qualities, I think, is he understood, maybe even before he fully understood it, that the nature of a mind that is prone to confusion, deluded thinking, and ongoing disappointing experiences is a distracted mind. So whether he realized it directly or simply understood it experientially, when he found something that didn't lead to concentration, he discarded it as not leading to his goal. And I won't go through that sutta on the Arya Pariyasana Sutta, but that's how he described these teachings as simply being more distraction. Over the summer and into the early fall, we went through that series of seven talks on jhana. This is one of them, so you might remember it from that. And I'll read the introduction to. Jhana means meditative absorption. The Buddha teaches in a general way four levels of meditative absorption or deepening concentration. As can be seen here, these four levels are not in a practical sense strictly defined. In other words, for the sake of conversation and teaching, they are strictly defined, but these four levels of ever-deepening concentration are something that are very impermanent and will typically find ourselves flowing from one to another and hopefully flowing towards ever deepening concentration, but we'll often fall back into one of the earlier levels. And again, using just as a way of communicating, there's different levels, but it really is just a single process of ever deepening concentration. That's what meditation is for. The development of concentration can and should be mindfully observed as concentration increases, and that's the usefulness of delineating the different or deepening levels. The four levels of jhana are impermanent and are developed from engaging in Shamatha Vipassana meditation, as taught by the Buddha, and should not be viewed as meditative achievement. Shamatha Vipassana meditation is not another opportunity for fabricating experience through continued confusion or continued desire, encouraged by misguided instruction. So the Buddha taught meditation for one reason. It was time to meditate, he said, go find the root of a tree or an empty hut, go find a secluded, quiet spot, and do jhana, meaning do a concentration practice. And in the Satipatthana Sutta, he taught us how to do that. The beginning part of that sutta establishes the four foundations of mindfulness as the foundation for a meditation practice, for a concentration practice. And I won't get into that. We're going to touch on that, I think it's next week, but I'm not sure. even though I wrote the book, I can't remember. In the Yoganata Sutta that is cited in this chapter, the Buddha teaches that a meditation practice must have two components. It must have shamatha, a way of quieting the mind or developing a tranquil mind. Shamatha is often translated as simply calm abiding, but that really misses the point that it's not just simply sitting calmly, it's actively engaging in calming the mind through concentration. There's a significant difference in that. And vipassana means to gain insight. And insight can arise on our cushions, but it's most often arises and is integrated in our moment-by-moment mundane lives when we're seeing things from the developing perspective of right view and within that broader framework. Is that clear? Mm-hmm. So the reason why I'm saying that is many of us, including yours truly, took to a meditation practice for a lot of reasons, all kind of around escape or feeling better. And that's okay if that's the initial motivation. That's why most people engage in a meditation practice, or to gain some superior, higher knowledge. All of those pursuits are prone to distraction because they're part of eye-making. Again, I won't get too deep into that, but we're going to touch on it. Lolo understands. We'll touch on that in week 6 and 7, how that occurs. And again, it's what the Buddha realized he was doing before he understood the true purpose of meditation, to deepen concentration. And if we remember that, and by the way, there is no mention of the word shamatha vipassana in the Pali Canon. It's a new derivation on older teachings, and I use it because it simply describes this whole practice that the Buddha described in the Yoganata Sutta. Any useful meditation practice must have those two components: a way to calm the mind by being mindful of the breath, supporting insight, and a very specific insight into the three marks of existence: the impermanence of all things, the misunderstanding of self, anatta, and the resulting disappointing experiences, dukkha, that follows from that first two. Okay. Free of grasping after, these levels of meditative absorption are simply the recognition that shamatha vipassana meditation is actually developing concentration. That's the whole point, and it's important to recognize that our efforts are bearing fruit.
Can you just read that sentence one more time?
Sure. And Lorna will always tell me if I'm reading too fast. So.
No, I faded out of the first part of the sentence.
Free of grasping after, these levels of meditative absorption are simply the recognition that shamatha vipassana meditation is actually developing concentration while avoiding creating further distraction. The point of that is that we shouldn't be grasping after the second level and the third level and the fourth level of meditative absorption as achievement, because it isn't. The Buddha teaches this, and you'll see when I finally get to the sutta. It's just, these are ordinary developments for an extraordinary meditation practice. It's what should be happening. The Buddha teaches it simply so that we will recognize that it's happening, that our meditation practice is bearing fruit. This aspect of right view then remains free of conceit or eye-making that would otherwise create frustration and distraction within shamatha vipassana meditation practice. The sequencing of the additional descriptions of non-physical meditative experience that follows a description of four levels of jhana should not be seen as advanced levels of meditation, as is commonly presented. And you'll understand a little bit more when I read the sutta. But often meditation is taught that we should chase after these establishments in non-physical realms to achieve the dimension of nothingness, or the dimension of neither perception nor non-perception, etc., etc. When you actually read the Buddha's teachings, he's cautioning against doing that, because think about that. If I'm sitting in meditation, hoping to find myself in the dimension of nothingness, what am I doing? I'm trying to establish myself in some imaginary, non-physical realm that the Buddha, that contradicts the heart of the Buddha's teaching, which is to unite a mind and the body right now in the present moment with life as life occurs. And so the antithesis of that would be, I'm going to put myself someplace else. I'm going to, again, the dimension of nothingness, neither perception or non-perception. These are things that the Buddha studied with Alara Kalama and Udeka Ramaputta that he mentioned often as not leading to the goal, even though those were two of the most advanced so-called spiritual teachers of his time, teaching this dharma. And their dharmas were based, and most of the popular, though always individually embellished, teachings of the Buddha's time were taken out of the, were based on the Vedas or the Upanishads, And most all spiritual teachers taught variants of that, which were the precursor for modern Hinduism. I'm not putting down modern Hinduism, but I am making the point that it's something that the Buddha studied, mastered, and rejected as not leading to his goal. He didn't say it was bad or wrong or nobody should do it. He never mentioned things in that way. He simply said, this is what I teach and this is what I don't teach. And he taught it for a very specific reason. So any establishment in a non-physical realm is simply more eye-making. And that non-physical realm doesn't have to be something mystical or magical, such as the dimension of nothingness or emptiness or neither perception, etc., etc. It can be, I want to establish myself in the dimension of the world's greatest baker. It's still an imagination. Even if it's true, it's still an imagination. It's still a self-referential view that once it's established in my mind is a constant distraction from what's actually occurring, which is baking really good cookies and not being concerned if anybody else notices it. And I'm being a little bit silly with the description. But the point is that any time we try to establish ourselves in our imagination in a non-physical realm, which is what that type of thinking is, it's the same as trying to do it in a mystical way. It's just as much of a distraction. Is that clear?
Very.
And so when you think about the whole purpose of the Buddha's Dhamma is to let go of wrong views, unite the mind and the body with what's occurring, there's no self in that, is there? Remember the Dhatuvibhaga Sutta, where the Buddha describes the six properties that make up a person, and there's nothing personal about any of those properties, is there? It's just what's occurring. And it takes a well-concentrated mind to be in its body, doesn't it? To be in its form. Laura and I had a great talk about this the other night, and we've been talking about that. To be here. If we're constantly looking to fix ourselves, better ourselves in some way, establish ourselves as better than some others, or to maintain self-referential views, such as I'm the world's greatest baker, the world's greatest Democrat, or the world's greatest Republican, or the world's greatest golfer, etc., 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 the world's greatest meditator, I'm out of my body, aren't I? And I'm in that imaginary idea that I hold of myself. Why do I do that? Why would any human being compulsively do that? It's what the Buddha awakened to. It's a common human problem of not understanding a self, isn't it? That's why the Buddha taught very specific insight into these three marks of existence. But why would I do it? Because I don't understand what I am, and the misunderstanding of what I am doesn't add up. It's not enough. I feel like there's something missing or something broken. And so I engage in practices that will distract me from seeing that, rather than a practice that shows me that's simply a wrong view. There's nothing to fix in, there's nothing broken, and there's nothing to gain. Except, as the Buddha described, an awakened human mind as calm and at peace. Shamatha. Or shamatha, as I usually call it. And there's nothing else. A self-referential ego self that's constantly grasping after every thought, word, and idea that occurs to it will reject that immediately. In fact, most people, when they first come to true Dhamma practice and realize the implications of what we're talking about, struggle with that, just that one idea. What's going to happen to me when I let go of all self-referential views? How will I function in the world? Pretty wonderfully well. You know, because you won't have to continually establish and defend what can't be established or defended. The Buddha described this thing, the five clinging aggregates, as like foam on the ocean. There's nothing here. And the stress and confusion arises from trying to protect that thing. Is that clear?
Mm-hmm.
A little bit of a speech there, but
yeah.
Appropriate.
Oh, it was good to hear.
These fabricated non-physical meditation experiences were part of the doctrines of Siddhartha Gautama's early teachers, Alarakalama and Udaka Ramaputta. Having mastered them, he immediately dismissed them as they do not lead to disenchantment, to dispassion, to cessation, to stilling, to direct knowledge, to self-awakening. It's an important line the Buddha used repeatedly. It's self-awakening. Our awakening is not dependent on some outside agency or some grace bestowed on us because we're such wonderful people or we do enough chanting or bowing or praying or etc. It's self-awakening that we establish that in our minds. This method only seeks to establish a reappearance in the dimension of nothingness, etc., these other dimensions. I'll skip over those. This is a realization that Siddhartha developed prior to his awakening. As such, it could have been taught to simply avoid any fabricated non-physical self-reference. In other words, the Buddha could have said, just don't do it. But he understood the nature of a mind rooted in ignorance to create these very powerful strategies to ignore its own ignorance. And one of them is just this, to continually establish yourself in your imagination. One of the breakthroughs of understanding Siddhartha had was insight into the powerful but very subtle strategies that a mind rooted in ignorance will develop and cling to in order to continue its own ignorance. With profound wisdom, the Buddha realized the attraction of continuing self-establishment in fabricated non-physical realms. He understood that the most effective method of understanding the foolishness of these doctrines that encourage continued eye-making would be to explain these common experiences in the context of shamatha vipassana meditation. In this way, these non-physical fabrications, when seen in the proper context, are simply ordinary fabrications to be recognized and abandoned. Dependent origination states that from ignorance of Four Noble Truths comes fabrications, and then the other 11 links that end up in a confused and deluded mind prone to suffering. Rooted in fabrications. The sequence, from ignorance of Four Noble Truths comes fabrications, from fabrications comes consciousness, but again, as consciousness not in a grand cosmic one mind sense, it's simply ongoing thinking rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths and informed by a fabricated or corrupted view of what's occurring. We had a little discussion that the Buddha would describe our view of ourselves in relation to the world as like an illusion. And it wasn't an illusion, but like an illusion, because we simply don't see what's there. And ultimately, it's because we don't understand what constitutes me. And we're going to get to that. Let me get to this. I think that's enough introduction for this, and I'll comment in the sutta. If I can find it. Okay. On one occasion, Venerable Ananda was at S's office to see the Valuvama Gamaka near Visali. At the same time, a householder, Dasama from Atatha Kanagara, was nearby in Pataliputra on business. Completing his business, Dasama went to Kukata Monastery to ask a certain monk a question. Where is Venerable Ananda staying? I would like to see him. The monk told him where Ananda was, and Dasama left immediately. Upon meeting Ananda, Dasama bowed and sat to one side. He had a question. Venerable sir, is there a single quality taught by the Buddha to be developed so that the unreleased mind of a Dhamma practitioner who is mindful, ardent, alert, and resolute in the Dhamma would attain release and security, from the yoke of clinging to views rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths? It's quite a question, isn't it? Mm-hmm. It shows that he has a very broad understanding of what the Buddha is teaching, but is looking for a little bit more insight. Ananda was the Buddha's cousin and his chief attendant for the last 25 years of his life. He also had a word-perfect memory, likely rooted in deep concentration. And it's Ananda primarily that we have the Buddha's teachings preserved in the Sutta Pitaka. Another story, though. Yes, there is, friend Dasama. When a Dhamma practitioner, secluded from sensuality and other unskillful qualities, enters and remains in the first jhana, This first jhana is experienced as rapture born of that very seclusion. So again, these are ordinary levels of meditative absorption using this extraordinary meditation method. And we all experience this, whether we realize it or not. And the purpose of this teaching is to recognize it. So when we start meditating and we become mindful of our breath and our body, and we find that we're caught up in our thoughts, distracted by our thoughts again, recognize that, simply recognize it. Don't analyze our thoughts. Don't figure out where they're coming from or what they mean. Simply come back to the sensation of breathing. This first level of jhana is established. And for beginning meditators, it might only be for a moment or two. But it's important to recognize that brief, undistracted moment during meditation is that first level of jhana. And for all of us as meditators, we've experienced that first level deepening. Yes? Mm-hmm. Yes. No, it's true. This first jhana is experienced as rapture born of that very seclusion. It simply means that we're meditating correctly. Pardon me?
And it feels good.
And that's okay if it feels good, as long as we don't chase after the feeling good. Rapture is a misunderstood word too. It rapture in this sense, it's not we're looking for the second coming. It means that we are fully mindfully present in a, what's the right word? Fully mindfully present with a deepening, ever deepening expectation of concentration. Another word for rapture would be standing in awe, and it is in that sense that we are sitting in awe of what's occurring within our own minds. That's a deeper level that we'll get into right now. It is accompanied by directed thought and evaluation, this first level, meaning that we're still directing our thoughts. We're still recognizing that we're caught up in our thoughts. We still have to tell ourselves, come back to the breath. And that's fine. That's not the fact that that's the first level of jhana doesn't mean that we're doing something wrong or we're not progressing. In fact, it means just the opposite. If we're recognizing that process, it means, guess what? You're meditating correctly. You're engaging in right meditation. And that's really the only way we should look at it. Despite the pleasure of this first jhana, they understand this first jhana is fabricated, impermanent, and subject to cessation. We know that we're going to move on. As they continue meditation, they enter and remain in the second jhana, the second level of meditative absorption. This second jhana is experienced as rapture and pleasure born of concentration. So now the second level, and it usually quickly follows that first level, is we realize that our minds are becoming more concentrated. And every one of us has had that experience, correct? Anybody hasn't? Put your hand up if you haven't, just because I can't. Okay. It's simply right meditation, but it's important to recognize. My mind is now more concentrated than it was a few minutes ago. And that concentration only deepens. Free of directed thought and evaluation, the joy of concentration permeates their entire mind and body. Despite the pleasure of this second jhana, they understand this second jhana is also fabricated, impermanent, and subject to cessation. We simply know that there's deeper levels of absorption, of meditative absorption. Continuing meditation, they enter and remain in the third jhana, which is equanimous and mindful, a pleasant abiding. With the fading of rapture, this pleasant abiding permeates their entire mind and body. Has everybody experienced that? Whether it's just for a moment or for a half hour, a pleasant abiding without the thought that it needs to be any different than it is. That's also the beginning experience of what a fully awakened mind feels like all the time, a mind resting in equanimity. Most of us go through this process using meditation within the framework of the Eightfold Path to fully establish that. Some of us, like Kundana, experience it immediately. Most of us got to put a little effort in. But it's important to recognize, again, that this effort is bearing fruit. And so we've all established that we've entered and remained in the third jhana. Despite the pleasure of this third jhana, they understand this third jhana is fabricated, impermanent, and subject to cessation. Continuing meditation, they enter and remain in the fourth jhana, which is pure equanimity and mindful. Being pure, neither pleasure nor pain is seen. We talked about this last week, wasn't it? About how you've had that, and probably all of us have too. You've had an experience in meditation where there was no self-reference.
I had one today.
Pardon me?
I had one today.
Right, yeah. And that's the fourth jhana. That's what that means. That non-directed thought, meaning that I'm no longer, even if it's just for a brief moment, in this moment, I'm not thinking of what I'm doing, what I need to do, how do I establish myself. I'm free of that burden. The Buddha talks about putting down the burden of self. It doesn't mean that once we do that, there's no human being engaging in the world. It simply means there's no self-referential being left in the world, living life from a fabricated point of view, a mind well concentrated and united with its body. That's the fourth level of jhana. So how many of us have experienced that fourth level of jhana? Every one of you? Yeah. The point I'm making is that there's nothing extraordinary about that, but to recognize that the practice itself is extraordinary. Meaning, and the point I'm making about that is that using meditation as the Buddha teaches, free of any embellishment or any other encumbrance, develops exactly what the Buddha wants and teaches. But when we embellish it or adapt it in any way, the whole entire Eightfold Path is lost. This is one of the reasons why the Buddha continually teaches it's this and it's not that. And in fact, in nearly every sutta, he makes that point, that if you want to develop an Eightfold Path, it can't be a Ninefold Path or a Sevenfold Path. Or it can't be a Ninefold Path or an Eightfold Path and you have to do a million bows, or an Eightfold Path and you have to do a specific chant. Those are things that Buddha never taught, that when looked at closely are establishing yourself in non-physical realms in one way or another. They sit permeated in mind and body with pure, bright awareness. Despite the pleasure of this fourth jhana, they understand that this fourth jhana is fabricated, impermanent, and subject to cessation. As concentration deepens, the mind is unbound, spacious, free of the confining yoke of ignorance. They are imbued with unlimited goodwill, with compassion, with empathetic joy, his mind resting in equanimity. Even so, this Dhamma practitioner understands that this release through goodwill, compassion, empathetic joy, and equanimity is fabricated, impermanent, and subject to cessation. All that means that even though we've achieved a fourth level of meditative absorption, there's still more work to do. And what is it? It's continuing meditation and continuing integration of the Eightfold Path. I got a question from an online student a while ago, and it put me back on my heels just for a moment because nobody ever asked. He said, why did the Buddha keep meditating after he was awakened? Why wouldn't he? Why wouldn't any of us? But the question showed that he was still using meditation as an escape or as a way of fixing something. And so once that escape is made or the fix is in, why would you continue it? But of course you continue it because it's a way of establishing and continue to establish a calm and peaceful mind. I'm going to skip over some of my commentary. Remaining well concentrated, they reach the end of the defilements. They abandon greed, aversion, and deluded thinking. If they do not reach the ending of the defilements right then and there, through their continued right effort, the five lower fetters will simply fall away. The five lower fetters of self-identification, grasping at rituals and practices, something the Buddha continually emphasized, because those rituals and practices during the Buddha's time, just as today, are simply rooted in eye-making in one way or another. Doubt and uncertainty, sensual craving, and deluded thinking, they all fall away. Furthermore, having abandoned self-identification with form, having abandoned aversion, having abandoned self-reference, now here and now there, they enter and remain in the perception of the infinitude of space. So again, this shouldn't be seen as achievements getting into these levels. The Buddha, in the context, Ananda here, is describing these as simply fabricated states. The infinitude of space, a dimension of infinite consciousness, the dimension of infinite nothingness, and and then to the dimension of neither perception nor non-perception. Again, these were things that were common during the Buddhist time and are still taught in many modern traditions, that this is the reason why we're doing this, is to establish ourselves in these higher realms. And that's part of the process of a meditation practice, where when you, and this is not the only sutta where the Buddha teaches us, there's hundreds where he says, avoid doing this, because it's simply looking to establish yourself in non-physical realms. We have enough time dealing with the physical self that we've established in this realm, much less get distracted by other realms. Even here, I mean, these different imaginary realms, even here they understand that any phenomena connected to five clinging aggregates, form, feeling, perceptions, fabrications, consciousness, is impermanent, stressful, a disease, painful, an affliction, and as such, anatta, not self. If it has any measure of confusion, deluded thinking, or suffering, it is anatta. It does not constitute a self. And remember that I can't remember the name of the sutta, we just did it 2 weeks ago, on the five clinging aggregates, and that they're all fabricated. And as we continue our delusion, we get caught up in this fabrications of fabrications. We get caught up in this feedback loop of misunderstanding. And the only way, this is the reason why the Buddha taught an eightfold path, the only way to recognize that is to have a framework for recognizing that we're doing it, to see our own ignorance. That's the purpose of an eightfold path, and it takes a well-concentrated mind to see it. Clear? Mm-hmm. They disregard these phenomena, meaning the five clinging aggregates are the Buddha's description of the personal experience of suffering rooted in ignorance. Right? They disregard these phenomena, the five clinging aggregates. They disregard the phenomena of a self suffering in the world. They disregard the phenomena and incline their mind to the cessation of ignorance. It makes perfect sense, doesn't it, when you understand the Buddhist teachings in its proper context. They disregard these phenomena and incline their mind to the cessation of ignorance. For the Buddha awakened to the fact, to the understanding, to the great knowledge that it is ignorance of Four Noble Truths that leads to all manner of confusion, deluded thinking, and suffering. So it would make sense that his path to awakening would directly address that singular problem of ignorance, isn't it? One of the most misunderstood words in modern Buddhism is anatta, and the Buddha used that word anatta, which was common during his time, and he used it because it was a common word, but in a completely uncommon and contradictory way. So anatta during the Buddhist time and even during today's modern practices is used to establish a doctrine of no self, which is quite a bit different than what the Buddha taught, which is a doctrine of not-self, meaning the views that we're holding of ourselves are rooted in ignorance. They're wrong views. They do not constitute a self. They're not a self. Let go of the views. But he never taught to establish the self in nothingness, or that there's no such thing as a self, or that the self is empty. It's at 10:30 already. Huh. Or that the self is empty. The Buddha taught emptiness to be empty of this one thing, ignorance. I'm going to read that once more. They disregard these phenomena and incline their mind to the cessation of ignorance. Nothing remains to provoke the becoming of further ignorance and the birth of continued suffering. Hence the name of the book, Becoming Buddha, Becoming Awakened. We are always in a continual process of becoming. The question is, what are we going to become in the next moment? This relates directly to karma and rebirth. If I have a mind that has a measure of concentration that can hold in mind the refined mindfulness of the Eightfold Path, then the next moment is another moment of becoming awakened. And if I, for whatever reason, don't have that well-concentrated mind or the refined mindfulness to hold in mind the Eightfold Path, then the next moment is simply going to become another moment rooted in ignorance. And it really is that fine line that each and every one of us is living, especially as Dhamma practitioners. What am I going to become in the next moment? And am I going to continue my concentration practice and integrating the Eightfold Path to to become awakened, or am I going to continue ignorance and continue all the confusion and delusion that follows from that? And that is that's the sole purpose of the Eightfold Path, and it's why the Buddha continually taught what it is and what it isn't. Because it's so easy to get distracted by other practices, so-called spiritual practices, especially when our friends and acquaintances are doing different things. And it feels good to do things as part of a social group, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. I remember going up to, I can say, Zen Mountain Monastery nearly every Sunday, and there'd be sometimes 100 people, sometimes even a few more than 100 people. And we'd all be engaging in practices that I would never even think of doing today. But while I was, and not because they're bad or wrong, but they're, to me, now they were just more distraction, but they felt good to do it as part of this great group. And then we'd have a nice meal afterwards, and it was a wonderful experience. But the whole time I was doing it, I became very good friends with John Lurie, who's recognized as one of the great Zen teachers of all time. So it was socially a great experience for me. But every time I left there, I was more frustrated and confused than before. And I couldn't understand that. I kept putting it on myself. There's something wrong with me. I just can't get this. And that's often how it's presented, that especially in modern traditions, that it takes endless eons to awaken. And so that was told me. I said, okay, but you know, if I just keep going, sometimes at the end of this endless eons, maybe I'll awaken. It finally got to the point where I realized that can't be right. An awakened human being could not have taught something that is this confusing and contradictory, and that required practices that seemed to have nothing to do with gaining understanding, including the rituals and stuff that they went through. And it was out of that and studying in the all the different Mahayana schools that out of that frustration that I said, there's got to be a way to find out what the Buddha actually taught and what he didn't. And that's when I looked at the Pali Canon, in particular the Sutta Pitaka, and it changed everything because of teachings like this, where the Buddha taught what it is and what it isn't. In all that time of different schools, I took my vows in a Tibetan lineage after quite a lot of study in that lineage. And it may sound politically correct that they taught this way, but nowhere was it ever taught that the Buddha taught this and not that. It was always kind of this all-inclusive, that it's all kind of the same thing and all paths lead to the same. In fact, most of the great modern Buddhist teachers say that, you know, there's a lot of contradiction in the different Buddhist lineages, but they all basically teach the same thing. Well, they don't. And it's confusing and contradictory to believe that. But that's what it was. That's how it was presented to me, so I said it's okay. Well, I really got off on a tangent. One of the things, the point that I'm making about that is the suttas that we talked about, particularly the Upada Sutta, where the Buddha teaches that as far as a Sangha is concerned, the importance of a well-focused Sangha. And we have established that in what I think is a remarkable way. We support each other in awakening, in becoming awakened, because as a Sangha, we have agreed to not engage in practices that the Buddha didn't teach. And that's such an important focus of what's developed here, and it really is remarkable. So excuse the long speech, but it relates to this, doesn't it? The Buddha continues, they will enter into pure, bright awareness, a pleasant abiding, totally unbound from clinging to wrong views. Listen to this line. Never to lose their mind again. Isn't that wonderful? So Ananda in this case is attributing not being well concentrated and holding that refined mindfulness as losing your mind. And think about it. That's exactly what the Buddha's teaching. Mm-hmm. An essence of a lost mind is a mind that believes the fabricated views, isn't it? No matter what the fabrication, the corruption, the perversion is, if we believe it, we've lost our minds. If I believe that I must establish myself in some other imaginary realm other than what I am, I've lost my mind. Why? Because it can't be done. I mean, just common sense would teach. The Buddha, I think, was the world's foremost radical thinker because he was a foremost logical thinker. I'm not a proponent of logic by itself. It was logic rooted in a profound wisdom of what the way things are. That's the Four Noble Truths. And so often, I talked a little bit today about many years in different Buddhist schools, very, very rarely, probably two or three times, did I ever hear Four Noble Truths or an Eightfold Path mentioned. And usually it was as they were mentioned as anachronisms, like it's an old-fashioned teaching, you really don't need that, what you should do is this, this, and this. It wasn't until I realized that everything the Buddha taught was taught in the context of dependent origination and Four Noble Truths that the Dhamma had any real meaning to me, and that's why I teach the way I teach. Ananda's concluding this. This, my friend, is the single quality taught by the Buddha to be developed so that the unreleased mind of a Dhamma practitioner who is mindful, ardent, alert, and resolute in the Dhamma would attain release and security from the yoke of clinging to views rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. The single quality, deepening concentration. Of course, the Buddha, Ananda mentions, resolute in the Dhamma. He could have said the heartwood of the Dhamma, because that refers, the Dhamma always refers to the Eightfold Path and then all of the other supportive teachings. So again, it's not something vague. It's not something that can be embellished or adapted. The Dhamma is very specific. Upon hearing these words, the Sama remarked, Venerable Ananda, it is as if a Dhamma practitioner were seeing a single opening onto treasure and all at once realized 11 openings to that treasure. In the same way, I was seeking a single doorway to the ending of all fabrications. All at once, you taught me 11 doorways I can take, all leading to the single point of cessation from fabricated views. Let me explain that, and I'll just read my commentary. The 11 doorways that the Sama is referring to are the four levels of jhana, the four fabricated realms that were mentioned here, and the three marks of existence, the 11 doorways. It's gaining an understanding of what all this means, recognizing what is simply distraction and abandoning it, and pointing our minds towards gaining an understanding of three marks of existence. Those are the 11 doorways. Venerable Ananda, all true teachers deserve a fee. I will pay homage to you. The Sama then gathered the Sanghas from Vasali and Pataliputta and prepared a feast for them. He gave a pair of cloths to each Sangha member and a triple robe to Ananda. He then built a dwelling for Venerable Ananda. The point of that, the ending of that, is just the respect and the reverence that a true Dhamma teacher deserves. So that's the end of the sutta. Thank you for listening. A long and important sutta, but to emphasize that single quality for awakening and why we meditate within the Buddha's Dhamma is to deepen concentration. And if we remember that, if we still get frustrated with our meditation practice that we're not quite getting it or we're not doing it fast enough or deep enough, when we remember that every time we find that we're caught up in our thinking and come back to the sensation of breathing, we're deepening concentration, we're doing jhana. And it's just that simple. And so as long as we can be mindful of that, there's no reason to get frustrated with it. We're doing it right. And as we incorporate that aspect of right meditation into the other seven factors of the Eightfold Path, we know that becoming awakened is guaranteed. Why? Because we've taken refuge. We understand that an awakened human being did just this practice, and this is what he taught others to do the same. And the many thousands of human beings that followed this path develop a well-concentrated mind and the refined mindfulness to be in their body as their life occurs. And that's its own reward. That's all we need. So let's go around the room, and I'd like to hear any questions or comments you have, and also what you got out of the chapter on Shamatha Vipassana meditation. And those of us that have been part of a Sangha for a long time, and anybody else too, how your understanding of the practical nature of Shamatha Vipassana meditation has increased in the effects it's had on your life. Jen.
that was a lot of questions. Okay. Yeah. Well, first of all, this starting up the course, your starting up the course again has been good for me because I just feel like it's reinvigorating my practice, which is, you know, has its ups and downs and has now sort of become a little more stable and beneficial. And rereading the book is, man, it's just good. It's really nice to have, to remember that it's available. I guess, what was the second question?
I don't know. No, you're understanding of the practical nature of Shamatha Vipassana meditation.
Mm-hmm. That's not the question I wanted to answer. there was something that I was reading that, you know, when I go through the book again, that there's these details that I'm seeing now that I'm understanding that I wasn't, that I think I just kind of broad stroked over before, that are refining the practice, which has been nice. It really feels like multitasking when I'm concentrating on my breath and also noticing thoughts and feelings arise. That really feels like requires like a lot of concentration to be able to really do both. I feel like I'm either concentrating on my breath or I'm watching my thoughts and feelings arise. Like to be doing both feels like requires a lot of concentration. So that reinvigorates my practice. I just really have to. Also, a lot of doubt and uncertainty, and am I doing this right? And maybe I need to, do something a little different. A lot of that stuff coming up. So it's nice to remember to kind of already have gone through the practice and know, like, okay, doubt and uncertainty are definitely hindrances. I can just drop those.
Yeah.
When I'm starting to roll around in my head about, well, maybe I need to do this a little different, or maybe I need to do that a little different. It's just, nope, just focus on your breath. Watch me like the thoughts arise.
Yeah.
So, I don't know if I answered your question, but.
You did. Thank you. Yeah, that last part, it's the Buddha talks about the hindrances often because a self-referential, self-identifying mind will fall into doubt and uncertainty and say, well, this can't be right.
Right.
From my point of view, it's not for me.
Yeah.
And so you're missing the whole point. You can't make decisions from that point of view.
Right.
And it kind of goes against refuge. I won't talk about, get too deep into that. But we recognize the benefit of this practice because we've experienced it ourselves. And we understand that doubt and uncertainty is part of it. What do? We engage in that sixth factor of the Eightfold Path, right effort, and keep going.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And our concentration increases. Meditation practice works as it's intended.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Judy, good to see you. How are you?
Good to be here. Fine. Thank you, John. I haven't been reading, but hopefully I will.
Good.
But it's always good to listen and hear and review, because it's not really review. Every time, it's just another opportunity to understand more.
Mm-hmm.
My practice is good, and I'm happy with that. And it in my life, it's really been so helpful. And I do catch myself all the time, like, with the mental fabrications, and bring myself back to where I am and look around me and see what's happening at the moment. Something that When I, okay, I'm going to say this, but there's, you know, there's always stress, of course, dukkha, and so when I have these, start these mental fabrications, and then I catch myself and I say, okay, don't go there, it's nothing. And I, beyond that, this is hard to explain, but kind of in interpersonal relationships, I'm catching myself in old patterns of doing, of and practicing the restraint of not doing that,
yeah.
Kind of just being there and hearing and, but then I feel like, sometimes I feel like when I'm practicing restraint and it feels good not to have to do these old things, is then where does aversion start? You know, where is the, am I avoiding being
a good mother,
a good, you know?
Mm-hmm.
That's a question that I have.
Aversion ends where, when wisdom arrives. So it takes a while to develop that and to know. Sometimes it's a very fine line, you know, between practicing wise restraint or following through on something that is a responsibility as a mother. But when we understand right speech, right action, and right livelihood, that is the guidance of when to speak, when to act, when to hold back, when to practice restraint. So an aspect of right speech is obviously that it's honest, but also that it is useful and necessary, meaning that when I open my mouth, that it's going to have a helpful effect and that the person I'm speaking to will actually be, actually will and is capable of putting it to wise use.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we understand, like, screaming at a kid is not, right, even if it's, you know, even if it might feel justified, is probably not right speech for a lot of reasons, even if it's an adult child. But when we know, I don't go out on a street corner in Frenchtown and tell everybody to put all their other beliefs aside and come follow me, because it's wrong speech.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're for a lot of reasons, I'm going to alienate people. It's falling on deaf ears. So it takes a while to develop that. But what you're describing, being able to practice restraint, is the essence of mindfulness and understanding it. So it doesn't, restraint doesn't mean that when we're practicing restraint, like I feel like I need to tell somebody, but I know it's just eye making and we don't. That's the essence of Dhamma practice. Some of us will blame ourselves. Well, I haven't progressed enough that I have to practice restraint. That's the essence of awakening, isn't it? To know when and how to practice restraint. At some point, we let go of all fabricated views and it doesn't arise. But it is at that point of contact with the world that we're developing and integrating the Dhamma.
Mm-hmm.
So good for you. I hope I answered your question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, what you just said about letting go of when mental fabrications aren't there anymore, it doesn't even arise. It's not even an issue. Yeah. Right.
Yes, but that it has arise doesn't mean that we're doing something wrong. It just means we need a little bit more right effort.
Right.
And look around at the peace that we're leaving in the world from
mm-hmm.
our restraint,
mm-hmm.
honestly.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know? There's very little we can do in the world. Dukkha occurs that is going to have a more profound effect on the world than our own individual awakening.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people would argue with that. In fact, the modern so-called engaged Buddhists will say, well, we got to fix the world before we should fix ourselves. It's really just the other way around, isn't
mm-hmm.
it?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, please.
Just in what you were asking, it just kind of like how you said it, you were talking about aversion. So if you're in a situation with another person and you're frustrated, aversion is aversion to what is happening in you. So if you're reacting to them, it's because you're avoiding what is coming up in you. But if you're listening and observing your own reaction to it with restraint, you're not averting.
Mm-hmm.
You're avoiding.
Oh yeah, it's a good point, Jen. Thank you.
Right? Yeah.
Practicing restraint is not aversion.
Yeah.
Aversion is a feeling that I don't want to be involved in what's happening,
uh-huh.
or I don't want this. You know, it can be focused on the future, but practicing restraint in the moment because you know that there it's rooted in wisdom is not aversion. It's wise. There's a whole section on the website on wisdom of restraint from the homepage drop down menu.
Mm-hmm.
And you read a couple of those. I'm not dismissing you, but that
mm-hmm.
I think you'll gain some understanding there.
Okay.
And something that you both mentioned, Jen too, that you're seeing more details. It's because you're developing the broader framework and understanding how dependent origination and Four Noble Truths applies directly to this and the three marks of existence. That's the essence of insight. You know, the first time you read the book, most of it was probably nonsense,
mm-hmm.
and rightly so, because it's something you never looked at before. But now you understand what these things are, and you understand the context in which to put them. And that's why I always stress, in fact, in most Dhamma articles that I write, I begin by saying you must understand dependent origination and Four Noble Truths to understand this, fully at least. You know? And you're gaining that understanding, so you're seeing it.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Lorna, good morning.
Good morning. You asked us to talk about meditation and things. Well, I have noticed a bit of a change in my meditation. That I used to have my best meditations at home. And more lately, I've sort of really had some really good meditations here in the Sangha. I seem to be like flipping.
Mm.
And what I referred to by just really being concentrating on my breath and not being aware of anything else, it's like you realize this is all that you are, just this sitting on this cushion with these, you know, with this body. That's all that I am, and that's about as peaceful as I can be on the cushion. It's just to realize that there's just nothing else to me than the breath and this. What's just doing this is it. That's it. That's all that I am. And then, you might have been saying this for years, and I've only just cottoned onto it. I don't know, but I've heard more recently you refer to the six properties, which is the fire, the wind, the earth, whatever.
Liquid space consciousness.
Right. To me, when you, that's looking at the Dharma in a positive way, because sometimes how you teach, you look at what it isn't, which is the kind of negative.
Be a negativa.
Yeah. But if you can see, looking at those properties, those six properties, they're beginning to mean more and more to me. In as much as that is all I am. That's it, that's me. And I just had a flash, and you can dismiss this if it's not what you want to do, obviously, but I just wondered if we could have like a poster or something up with those six properties.
Okay.
Just for us to be reminded every time we come here.
We got to put all our pictures around it, though. That's what
but I know I would have like 100 post-it notes over here, you know, I get this and this and this. So, I mean, you don't want to do that with the room, but they are important. They're so important because it's a way of explaining and telling me all that I am, and that's all that I am, and those six properties. So I just wondered if we could have sort of like a visual reminder that we could.
I'll work on it.
Okay.
That and when we let go of all false views, wrong views of self, misunderstood views of self, those six ordinary properties become themselves extraordinary in a certain way, don't they?
Mm.
You know, and there's nothing personal about them.
Mm. Absolutely. That's why the six properties. There's nothing personal about them.
Yeah, it's such a powerful sutta too. To,
mm.
You know, we miss. Let's see. We lost somebody, but David's gone. Mary's here. Why don't you, Mary, why don't you turn your mic on, or I can? I will. Good morning, Mary.
Good morning, John. Can you hear me?
I can. How are you?
Oh, I'm good. I'm good. Good morning, everyone.
What happened to David? He was online just a few minutes ago.
Yeah, he had a 10 o'clock call related to this impending snowstorm. So,
okay.
Some of his business involves transportation, so...
Yeah, he's going to have a busy weekend.
He was called away by real life. But it's wonderful to be going through this again. The first time I read your book, John, I read it twice in one weekend because so many things resonated.
It's a great ending, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, the happily ever after party. But it's wonderful to come back to it, to A, acknowledge the progress that we've all made, and to hear the nuances and the specialness of the details, as you said, in a different way. As Lorna said, you're hearing things in a, just a more nuanced way, because the layers of understanding have deepened, you know, within each of us. So it's very helpful, and I can witness it on many days where I'm going through something that would have been, I don't know, very threatening or nerve-wracking or whatever, and I'm, you know, every day having right view, every day finding myself being actually more skillful. And so my skillfulness will probably produce the outcome I'm looking for versus panicking about the situation and worrying about my job or the future or whatever. I'm actually performing at a higher level during this sort of time of transition. I also witness it in other relationships right now, too, where... I often talk about the parenting thing, you know, that draws a lot of emotion and fabrications and all sorts of things for me, and being more skillful in that space as my children become adults. So I see it every day, and it's realizing what things are, what they are not, what this practice is, what it is not. I'm not perfect. I'm on a path, but it's so helpful. And I just experience it many, many times every day. And I'm so grateful to be going through this again with all of you. So thank you.
Me too. Thank you, Mary. What you're describing is a depersonalization of your life. You're simply not taking things personally. And so you're able to be... It's an interesting paradox, isn't it? That when we stop taking things personal, we're much more present for what's actually occurring.
Well, that's the beauty of it all.
Yeah.
And the fact that things aren't personal, it just lightens the burden of life.
Yeah.
Because I've made so many things personal, I thought that's what I was supposed to do.
Yeah,
I thought that was, you know, the energy and the commitment and all this stuff, but it ended up being like a big bag, like Santa Claus's bag, you know, on my back.
Yeah, that's just how the Buddha describes it.
And you know, live this great life when, you know, that's not the way to live this great life. Put the bag down. The burdens go.
The burden of self.
And give yourself permission to just be right now.
Yeah. Thank you, Mary. Glad you joined us today. Lolo, welcome to our Sangha.
Thank you.
How was your meditation and your class today?
It was good. I just recently started meditating on a regular basis. I had a couple months where I had a sick family member, so I were like all over the place. And I think I told you, like, when I first came in, I have a little meditation, my 365 breath, when I run into the corner real quick and get a little bit relief. But yes, today meditating, my thoughts were going anywhere. I was able to bring back to breath. But it was a struggle at times. But then, at some point, I was able... It wasn't just a brief moment. It was maybe like 2 seconds or 3 seconds, more than just 1 second of this. And then, thoughts would come in again. But I can bring myself back. So it's good. It's coming along. Yeah. And as long as I remember to be present, bring back to breath, and do that, it gives me a lot of relief.
Yeah.
And hope that this is a practice, and I'm practicing,
yeah.
I have to continue to practice.
Yeah.
So today, my first day being here, I feel really good. Reminding me a lot of stuff and also learning new stuff. So, thank you.
Thank you. I'm so glad you joined us, and I hope you continue to join us. And again, remember, I said it 700 times today, that
mm-hmm.
meditation is just part of the Eightfold Path.
Mm-hmm.
There's, on the website, there's guided meditations, just like we did here, from 5 to 45 minutes that you can download and listen to. And if you start from that page, for new visitors, or the page on Wisdom of Restraint, you'll get a pretty quick understanding of, and broader understanding of, what we're talking about. But you have a pretty good understanding of this anyway. So again, welcome to our Sangha. It's getting a little bit late. I want to hear from each and every one of you, but you know, if you could keep it a little bit briefer. Matt's gonna, it's 10 after 10.
Oh, wow.
Matt has a class. Oh yeah, and Matt does have a Qigong class today that you should all stay for. It's really remarkable. Anthony, good to see you this morning.
Good morning. So I was kind of struck by the interdependence of this all. And I was just thinking, like, because I've gone on the internet and researched meditation groups, and I've always seen just Vipassana, and I wonder why we say Samatha Vipassana, and it's not so common out there. And I think, like, it's so, the concentration is dependent on the insight, the insight's dependent on the concentration. And I was thinking, well, the teachings are strengthen the meditation, and the meditation strengthen the teaching.
Yeah.
And then I said, well, the Sangha is sort of like the vessel that contains it all, the life coaches that go
mm-hmm.
give us the strength and motivation to say, go out there and hit another good week, you know?
Yeah.
So I was thinking, wow, this is like all so interdependent. And the and then losing the mind made me think, well, that's mindlessness.
Yeah.
And the Buddha teaches mindfulness.
Yep, it's just that way. That's great insight.
Yeah.
The modern insight movement, Vipassana movement, began in Burma by a guy called Ledi Sayadaw, who was, I think he was about 20 at the time. And he was concerned, the British were just starting to colonize Burma. And he was concerned that it was a Buddhist country,
mm-hmm.
that Buddhism would be lost if somebody, meaning himself, didn't do something to really reestablish it strongly in the society. But he didn't have a complete understanding of what the Buddha taught, and he also wanted to teach a meditation method that, in fact, I still remember his words, any farmer cart driver could incorporate into their daily life. So he began with a hybridized understanding of what meditation was. And so the insight meditation followed from Ledi Sayadaw to his students, finally left Burma, came here. The insight movement is probably the third largest Buddhist practice, but it has very little resemblance to what the Buddha taught because of the purpose and intent, which is not keeping Samatha Vipassana meditation as one practice, and also the insight is to first calm your mind and then to analyze what's arising in your mind. I'm giving a very brief description,
yeah.
but to analyze what's coming up in your mind rather than, and that just, when you relate that to what the Buddha taught, that's just simply treating your thoughts as more fodder for distraction, isn't it? Rather than putting aside your thoughts and your feelings and coming back to the sensation.
The Shamatha part is basically coupling the thought and maybe saying to yourself, okay, that's distress and ill pass and going, you know, and then moving back to the breath.
There's a lot of,
it's just the noticing part, right?
Well, but there, it's also often taught to label what's occurring
mm-hmm.
rather than, and again, it goes against, it's a different practice. It's fine if that's what you want to do. It's just something different than what the Buddha actually taught, and it doesn't necessarily deepen concentration.
And then just a brief observation on the other part that you asked about is how it's affecting you personally. I think I feel that going being part of this for so long that I definitely have a deeper sense of a calmer abiding. Mm-hmm. And I know that yesterday I felt myself get immediately triggered because I got an email on a case that I'd worked out a settlement on in August, and I'd been very kind and, you know, and constantly followed up with emails and phone calls and given one adjournment because she doesn't have authority, and a second adjournment. And then yesterday I had my client already. She's on her way to court. I'm on her way to court. I get an email. I don't have authority. And I said, okay, this has gone on. She said, well, I'm having somebody cover it. I'm going on vacation, but we can adjourn this. And I said, no, I need to be there because this has gone on for far too long. And I knew I was driving 2 hours, one hour each way, probably wasting my time going to court to ask the judge to put the case on the trial list, because I knew that that may be the only way that an insurance company will actually settle the case with me until they walk to the edge of that plank. And of course the judge said no, but I felt like I just remain calm the whole time, and I could be fully present and not get angry at the judge. My adversary didn't even show up, so that could have made me more angry. But I just felt like, all right, I somehow loaded it in my mind that this wasn't going to be productive, but I needed to do it.
Yeah.
You know, to I just, you know, so I said, all right, I'll have some podcasts on that I enjoy, and, you know, I'll just enjoy the ride. And I think that's been the hardest part, to separate the feelings of aversion from the reaction. And I was able to do that.
Yeah.
And never aroused those feelings I had when I first picked up the email.
Yeah.
So that's how it helps.
It's remarkable. Again, you're describing not taking things personally. And probably doing your job better. You know, you're simply more mindfully present. So it's just how it's supposed to work. Matt, good to see you this morning.
Good to see you as well. Well, being fairly new to this group and just getting the book, I can't really comment on the teachings of the past or the book that much. But to the meditation, I was thinking today, I have a little nice little meditation spot at home, and have, I'm sure as we all have, you know, been consistent at times and less consistent at other times. But I'm fairly used to meditating alone in that spot, so I found it interesting when I got back. It's been several years since I've been in more of a group, and I'm sit down in the cushion, I'm thinking to myself, oh, a lot more people in here today, and this mat feels a little different than it usually feels, and all these things going through my head, and this and that, and this and that, and this and that, and then finally sort of, you know, let that go and deepened into it, and it just made me realize how much, you know, the sort of off the cushion, the practice of this practice, to what you're saying, really relates to the experiences you come into in the world, and being able to just sort of not get caught up in, oh, this mat feels a little different than I'm used to, or this is a little bit more crowded. And the general practice of that in all things as you go about your day. And I know for myself, I often want to be the best, as you said, the best baker. So just focusing on, you know, just baking some good cookies on the regular was a good one for me.
Thank you, Matt. Lisa, good to see you this morning.
Great to be here. And that's part being here. It's a big...
Yeah.
It's important. We keep coming back and not able to all the time, or not prioritizing it all the time. But I hope that that's not disrespectful.
No.
But more, I'd like to turn it around more as what keeps us coming back. And it's hard to describe. So I think this is the third time of beginning Buddhism. And the first time in the book, Becoming Buddha, you know, I have my yellow marker, my yellow highlighter, and, you know, a pen to also write little notes and things like that. I had no idea what I was reading. I had little idea, and also I didn't know the terminologies. So that was a bit of a stumbling block, is getting to know the words.
Yep.
And then the second time, and I read through the book a second time when we were going through it. I wasn't always here, but I read it. It was like, oh, I think something is making more sense to me.
Yeah.
And then I read Shamatha Vipassana last night, that chapter. And it's just like seeing things in a totally different way. Every time I read it, there's different meanings and more meanings and here. And I just think some things I just have to accept. It's just like when you don't know something and you just want to know it right away and not go through the agony of, you know, like learning something. Just let it happen over time.
Yeah.
Absorb, osmosis. I was trying to think of that word the other day for something. And I think it's just absorbing it in ways that I can't even understand.
Yeah, thank you, Lisa. And it really is just that way. That's that. You hear me say so often, we are so fortunate to have this remarkable Sangha that is so well focused. Because none of us can do it alone. That's what the Buddha told his cousin. A well focused Sangha is the whole of a Dhamma practitioner's life. Mm-hmm. And for just that way, to keep coming back to it, you hear things differently, you see things in it the third, fourth, fifth time through that you never saw before. And that's all about developing the right context. I'm glad you're here this morning. Eva, good to see you.
I'm very grateful to be here with everyone and with you. One of the most important things I've learned with you is to be gentle with yourself, with myself, because any time that I start getting these little struggles and whatever, I just kind of say, the most important thing right now is just to be gentle with myself. And when I do that, things start to become a little clearer. I let go of things that I might not have before, because that's what being gentle to myself requires. So that's wonderful. I read last night some of the Shamatha Vipassana, and as all of us, when reading it the first times, you know, I don't understand, I can't get this, but you know, I tried to osmos it, and it worked, you know, some. But I have to say that what I came to most appreciate is what a good writer you are, and how one sentence and then the next sentence, and it's like, wow, there's so much meaning. How did you, and I understand it, and how did you put all that into this one sentence? So I am utterly grateful.
Thank you for saying that. Nobody's ever accused me of being a good writer. I write a lot. Thank you. I'm glad you're here. Jay, quickly, it's almost 10:30.
I had a big fight all week with eye making. It was up, I was down. It was up, I was down. I rest my case.
You're in the right place. Thank you. I'm going to kind of buzz through this because Matt's got a class. We'll finish with Metta as we always do. So you'll read the next chapter in the book and we'll talk about it and I'll send an email out. You can sign up for the newsletter online too, and it describes the classes and what the suttas will be on too, and there'll be links to that.
Okay.
So again, I hope you join that. So find your relaxed meditation posture. Gently close your eyes and gently close your mouth. And again, take a moment to become mindful of your in-breath and your out-breath. And these are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another, Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class this morning. Peace.
Thank you, John.
Thank you, John.
Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.